Oral argument in State versus Scott McDaniel White, docket number 47976. We are conducting this hearing via Zoom. Present on behalf of Mr. White is Douglas Phelps, and on behalf of the state is John McKinney. Mr. Phelps, you may present your opening argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. The facts of this case are that the sentencing court, at the time of the sentencing, had made a decision prior to coming onto the bench. And Mr. White, at the time of the sentencing, the government presented testimony, unsworn testimony, from a member of the prosecutor's office. They had modified some exhibits that recorded the crime that occurred in this case and what occurred, and they modified that. We objected to that at the time of the sentencing, and then the government's employee presented statements that were unsworn, and the defense was not given an opportunity to question. The defendant has minor criminal history involving driving under the influence, no felony convictions, and as the court made findings in this case that he was rightfully upset and that he had been attacked prior to the shooting that occurred in this particular case, and had defended himself against an assault that occurred out in the parking lot. Ultimately, the court sentenced him to 25 years to life with a fixed term of 25 years. We challenge that the defendant hadn't been given his Article 1, Section 6 rights under the Idaho Constitution, and that he was denied his Sixth Amendment rights when the court failed to make findings on the objections to the pre-sentence investigation report. I believe the government's conceded that some of the factual information in that was not correct. And nevertheless, the court made findings and did not clearly identify whether or not the court was considering the allegations that were objected to or the prior criminal acts that were identified in the pre-sentence investigation. We also argue that the sentence here did not properly take into consideration the sentence in light of other crimes. Mr. Reedall made an objection at the time of sentencing, or actually statement at the time of sentencing, that proportionality, arguing for proportionality in the sentencing, the court disregarded that sentence of Mr. White to 25 years. I think that kind of summarizes up our arguments. I'd like to reserve the balance of my argument until after the state makes their arguments. Unless there's any questions.
Here to be none, Mr. Phelps, thank you. Mr. McKinney.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, or Judge, I'm sorry, Lorello. I'm getting used to that. I had planned a whole full-fledged defense, and I'm not quite sure what to respond to this. In listening to Mr. Phelps's argument, it seemed to be a very broad outline of what his issues are and what his arguments are from the brief. I would, before I go on and forget this totally, page 6 of the respondent's brief, the state did not agree that the statements made in the PSI that were also from the Gain 1 assessment, we did not agree that they were inaccurate. We said that at page 6, we said that they were not inaccurate. And if I recall from math, double negative means positive. So we're saying that it's an accurate PSI. So I wanted to clarify that. I went back and checked because it wouldn't be unlike me to have put the wrong word there, but I'm pretty sure the word is inaccurate, not inaccurate. So we do not agree with that. The issue that I'd first like to take, and I guess I'll take them in order and briefly go through them, but the district court's comment when she came onto the bench for the sentencing hearing was that she said, "Mr. White, I came into court with a pretty strong idea what my sentence was going to be because I take a lot of time in preparing. And what I have heard from you, from the attorneys, from the other people who spoke today is very important to the court. It hasn't changed my view of what I came into court with." Well, by her own words, the judge did consider the allocution of the defendant, the statements that were made by witnesses and other information that came in and the arguments of counsel. And she deemed that all very important in her consideration. Well, the fact that she came up with a tentative view of, in her, sounds like very extensive pre-sentencing preparations of what the sentence should be or what the range would be or an idea of what the sentence should be is not something that should be a problem. It would be really asking a judge to not be human, to engage in a preparation for a sentencing hearing in one, in a case that's as important as this one with as many documents and things to look at, and to not come up with an idea of what the sentence should be going into the hearing. And she did that. And I'm not aware of any authority, nor has any been presented, which would preclude that from happening. There's just nothing out there that I could find that could that says that a judge cannot engage in a tentative idea of what a sentence should be as they come onto the bench for a sentencing hearing. And so given that, I think this court was being, or the trial court was being very honest and open and saying that, yes, she had formulated an idea of what the proper sentence should be when she was doing her very thorough preparations. And so, and then she went through the hearing and she fully considered everything that was presented, including the allocution of the defendant, and said that her idea was pretty much unaffected. Her idea when she came into the court was unaffected by what she had heard. And so she issued the sentence that she did, 25 to life, which seems pretty appropriate given the facts of this case. The next issue is the challenge to the PSI, the pre-sentence investigation report, which incorporated the game one assessment into it. And the first thing that I'd argue, I just rely on my brief. It's there's this issue is not preserved because there was no adverse ruling. The defense counsel could have asked for a decision on his objection to the things that he pointed out in the PSI, but he did not. He did not ask for a ruling on whether or not the court was finding that information that was in the PSI, I can find the words here, inaccurate, unfounded, or unreliable. He made no such request and no ruling was made on that.
Mr. McKinney?
Yes.
Are we talking about the PSI itself, as in the document prepared by the pre-sentence investigator, or the gain evaluation?
I think we're talking about the gain evaluation that was incorporated into the PSI documents.
And what authority would a district court have to redline a gain evaluation?
Only, I don't think there is any that I can cite, but only I would imagine if it's incorporated into the PSI, would that possibly be the case? But here, the court is right. The gain one assessment was simply referred to by the PSI, and I'm not aware that it was fully incorporated. It was referred to, but and I think even more importantly, the statements made in the gain one assessment, assuming that it would be subject to being redlined, if inaccurate and whatever the terminology is here, inaccurate, unfounded, or unreliable, the statements were not inaccurate. They were very accurate. The problem here is that both at the sentencing hearing and I think carried on through the opening brief of counsel on appeal, he takes the wrong time frame for the 1 year or the 4 to 12 month period in which the defendant is being asked about as far as his alcohol use and or substance use. And that time frame is from the day of the Gang One interview, which was January 2nd, 2020. So when you backdate 12 months from that, it does cover the date of the incident here by at least within 10 and a half months. And so, but he kept saying that it's not within 12 months. And that would be true if the statements had been made at the sentencing hearing, but they weren't. They were made a month and a half earlier, and that would have covered the date of the incident when he acknowledged that was the last time that he had used controlled substances or alcohol. And so that's the main flaw here, is that there's simply, it's wrong on the facts, on the assumption that the 1 year period would not show any alcohol use. It did show alcohol use because the time frame that he was using is wrong. The time frame should have been when the statements were made, when Mr. White was asked when he last used alcohol. That was at the January 2nd interview with the Gain evaluation. So
back to my redlining question, Mr. McKinney, are there any limits on that? Does the district court have to redline any document attached to a pre-sentence investigation report, such as a police report or an indictment?
Chief Judge, I would imagine that it depends on how the wording or referencing in the PSI to the attached document is made. If it seems to be embracing the statements made in the attached evaluation or assessment, then I would think that the likelihood of being or the rule of redlining would apply certainly much more than if it's just a statement of the evaluation said this, the evaluation said something else, as opposed to embracing and incorporating and relying on what the evaluation said. And I think to take that further, here, the PSI investigator didn't actually rely on it. The PSI investigator simply stated what the Gain One assessment said, which was that the last alcohol use that he admitted to in the Gain One assessment was on the date of the incident. And I don't think that any hay was made of that by the PSI investigator. So it's probably not a good answer, but I'm not aware of any cases that would give direction as to how far the redlining would extend if there are other evaluations attached to a document or to the PSI.
Mr. McKinney, if I could just follow up, I want to make sure that I'm understanding your position. So am I understanding correctly that if the PSI quotes something from an attached evaluation, a Gain or a domestic violence, some kind of evaluation, and that information is quoted in the PSI, and in the PSI itself, that information is incorrect, is it your position that that information could be redlined in the PSI and because it's quoted also in the evaluation or just in the PSI?
Well, that's a very, very good question. And I think then it gets down to what we were talking about, I think, with Chief Judge Lorello, is how much of embracing of the evaluation or assessment is the PSI doing? If it's going to bat for that and depending on that assessment or evaluation for a recommendation made by the investigator, then yes, I would believe and think without any authority that I'm aware of, but I would think that a redlining would be appropriate. If that is part and parcel of what the PSI investigator's comments are overarching, whether a specific recommendation for a sentence or a comment on the defendant's attitudes or family upbringing, if there's something in another document that is relied on by that PSI investigator in making such a statement, then yes, I would believe that redlining would be in order. as opposed to a mere repeating what another document says. So I think that would be hard to determine, except on a case-by-case basis and based on what the PSI investigator says in regard to that attached document. And here, I'm not aware that anything was done other than repeating what those statements were. And then again, more importantly, those statements were accurate. Mr. White admitted that he had consumed alcohol on the night of the incident of the homicide, and that came within 1 year of when he was asked that question.
Thank you.
There is, and again, there is no ruling that was made here. And looking at the court's comments, when the recitation of counsel and the dialogue went on as far as pointing out errantly what he thought were inaccuracies in the PSI or the gain one assessments, the court said something that really showed that it made no opinion on whether or not these items were inaccurate or unfounded or unreliable. It simply said, I made these and we will get them filed. By saying I made these, it's totally unclear whether or not the court was saying I've made these changes or I've made these notes of what you're saying. We have no way of knowing. And I would submit that that points to the need here for counsel to have asked for a specific ruling at that point, because we just can't know. The record doesn't disclose whether or not the court may have crossed out those things, those statements, or just made notes on what counsel was saying was the inaccurate parts of the gain one assessment. At that point, he should have asked for a ruling, a specific ruling. He's, according to the Golden decision, he's made a motion to strike just by virtue of the court having asked, are there any additions, subtractions, deletions, and that's fine. But he's got to do more than make a motion to strike. He has to ask for a ruling if he doesn't get one. And he failed to do that here. So going back to the very first argument, he has waived that argument on the PSI by simply not obtaining a ruling. I'd like to touch on the three due process arguments that he has made, and they're, I guess I'd call them A, B, and C, but he's argued that his due process rights were violated because the court admitted a modified set of videos that were prepared by a Kootenai County investigator, Larry Kirkhart. And then that was the first challenge. And the second, he's claimed that the unsworn testimony of investigator Kirkhart should not have been admitted. And then finally, that he was denied the right to confront investigator Kirkhart. First, and I won't go through these, I think they're set out in my brief, but as far as all three of those due process claims, he's waived them on appeal by failing to argue them or present argument and authority under the Zizko decision. And all three of them just simply have not been presented with those two requirements under Zizko. The last two, the failure to put Mr. Kirkhart under an oath and the claimed violation of his right to confrontation have not been preserved. He failed to object to them and also failed to obtain an adverse ruling by which this court can review. So I'll skip to the merits of those three very quickly. The video modifications that were done, investigator Kirkhart testified about his training and experience. I think he had over 400 hours of training, and he described the three videos that were put into evidence and that were shown. Exhibit one was 2 minutes, and that was one that was taken from the original 2-hour and 40-minute video from surveillance cameras that were on top, I think, of the roof of this bar and looked over to the parking area where this crime occurred. And there were no alterations to exhibit one. So that's kind of a irrelevant exhibit in this discussion. Exhibit two was 10 minutes and 7 seconds, and it showed, and it was very high quality video, and the investigator testified that because of that, he was able to enhance it and make it much more easy to see. And it had two different things that were added to it. One, there was a picture in a picture of briefly when the camera one, people who were being seen by camera one went out of view, then camera two kicked in. And so it shows that briefly when the two people are out of the view of camera one, it shows camera two and where they're at, and then comes back to camera one. And then finally, there's picture in a picture of the magnified part of the action that occurred that evening. And then exhibit three is a 1:18 video, which is an extreme close-up of about 7 times magnification of what happened. And it's at about half speed where the motions and actions are very clear to see, although they are pixelated. And I would point out, I should have done this at the beginning, but the rules of evidence are not applicable to sentencing hearings, and the court has broad discretion in what evidence is admitted. Well, prior to the sentencing hearing, White objected in writing to the admission of those videos and said that he didn't like the manner of the editing, which cannot be verified, and said that the defendant proposes that the full version of the video be disclosed. So then he goes to the hearing, and he then argues that the modifications that they've made changed the representations about what occurred on that night, and that it was improper to admit those. The court asked him, in what way are you claiming the representations have changed? And counsel said that it was changed the timeline, the speed, and I think summarized by saying the court doesn't get the feel for what happened in a real-time continuum, to which the court replied, does it make any difference that kind of as asked in the written objection, that I viewed the videos that you offered the court, which you said were the videos several times, and so I've seen them in real time. And at that point, counsel backed off. He said, well, I have high regard for the court and its opinion and its ability to discern, but my greatest concern is that this is something that was produced by the prosecutor's office and not any outside agency. And he was questioning whether it was proper at all for this evidence to come through that agency. The court pretty much disregarded that last part, and there was no more argument about that. And the court ruled that the videos could come in, and it said, with regard to slow motion, I've never seen anything in slow motion in real life, and I can distinguish between those. With regard to magnification, the court said that sometimes enhancements can certainly help in viewing a grainy video. So I'm not aware of anything that White has come up with, either at the sentencing hearing or on appeal, that would show a valid answer to the court's question. What has changed? What are the misrepresentations? Yes, there have been enhancements done in the brightness, the contrast, the fuzz, reducer. But what has changed? What actions between parties or objects appearing? What is different? And he has never come up with anything. And I would, for lack of a better analogy, come up with football. We have slow motion and magnification used routinely in football games to see whether or not a football has actually gone over the white line of the touchdown line. And it's done in enhancements. It's changed the real life. We don't see in real life in slow motion and magnification, but to get a better and clearer view of what actually happened. The NFL and college football, they depend on those enhancements to better ascertain what happened when they're called to do so. Here, there's been no explanation as to why any of the enhancements that were done by the last two videos would have changed the party's actions, changed the objects they were holding, changed what they were doing with the objects, or anything. It's simply a complaint about there being enhancements because, well, it's unfair. And that's not a valid argument, and I would ask this court to reject it. The second of the due process claims is the lack of an oath, and that's not much for me to say other than what's in my brief, and so I'll rely on my brief on that. And also, then the third due process argument is that he was not allowed to cross-examine Investigator Kirkhart. in looking at the colloquy that occurred toward the end of Kirk Hart's testimony, actually after the state had ended, the defense attorney said, I don't have any other evidence. And then asked about whether the court had reviewed a report from Dr. Mabee. The court said, I did. And then the counsel for White said, asked again whether the court had reviewed the PSI. The court said, I did. And then counsel repeated, we have no other evidence, Judge. I don't know if you want argument. Well, testimony, or even cross-examination testimony, is evidence. And so defense counsel said twice, I don't have any other evidence, which would indicate that he has no interest in having testimony or cross-examination from Mr. Kirk Hart. On top of that, he said, and he skipped himself from procedural, the sequence procedurally should have been cross-examination, but he himself set the stage for skipping over that by asking the court, I don't know if you want argument. So he's jumping over that and just showing no interest in cross-examining Larry Kirk Hart. At the very least, in this case, there's absolutely no showing that the court interfered with counsel's ability to cross-examine Larry Kirk Hart, and there's been no authority whatsoever to show that the court had a duty to expressly ask defense counsel if they wanted to cross-examine the witness. Barring those two things being shown, there's simply no viable argument here that there was a confrontation clause violation based on the inability to cross-examine Mr. Kirk Hart. And I think that takes care of all of the issues that were argued. I would certainly submit the excessive sentence argument and based it on my briefs. I would say, just in passing though, this is the first time I have ever seen a homicide on surveillance video or any video actually occurred. The videos are shocking, they're stunning. And the attempt in watching what happened, especially toward the end of this conflict between Mr. White and Mr. Clark, is it speaks for itself. This came nowhere close to being the equivalent of a manslaughter. This was intentional act to kill Mr. Clark, and it is borne out by the videos, and I don't need to say anything more. I would ask this court to affirm the sentence of Mr. White, unless there are any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McKinney. Mr. Phelps, I think you have approximately 26 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes. May it please the court, this case is an interesting case in that what occurred was in the bar earlier. Mr. White had been confronted by four individuals and that were upset that he was making noise in the bar. In that confrontation, there was a slapping of the victim in this particular case. That had broken up. Mr. White and his fiancée had left the bar and were out. Mr. White was out in the parking lot. It was a very icy night, very bad conditions in the parking lot. In the unadulterated video, Mr. White can be seen struggling to get across the parking lot in the ice. Then in that video, you can see the victim come out, chase Mr. White down in the parking lot and begin to slap him and hit him repeatedly. Mr. White was backing up to in retreat, fell down, was picked back up, brought back up by the victim, who proceeded to continue to assault Mr. White. Mr. White was knocked down, got up. There was a weapon that had fallen on the ground. The weapon was picked up, and the man came back towards him, and Mr. White shot him. The issue that was highlighted through the slowing down and the modified video dealt with the breakup of time. Mr. White responded quickly shot, and then as the victim was going down, fired additional shots. That was the information that then after he was down, he did approach him again in all candor on the video. And then it was a quick, and the court did make some statements regarding that, that Mr. White has no felony history and the report of proceedings 55 through 56. The court recognized that alcohol played a part in what occurred in the report of proceedings 56 through 57 and acknowledged that Mr. White was provoked in this case, report of proceedings 59, and that Mr. White would have justifiably been outraged that Mr. Clark was chasing him and repeatedly hitting him, blow after blow, in the report of proceedings on page 59. The court did not consider the effect of the head blows to him that was in a medical report from Dr. Mabee, and the court failed to consider the potential rehabilitation given the alcohol issues. This case is very similar to the case of Skate versus Nice, 103 Idaho 89, at page 90, the 1982 case of State versus Owen, 72 Win 394 at 402, a 1953 case. It is similar to a manslaughter in that there was provocation and the court made findings that there was provocation in this case. Nevertheless, the court sentenced him to a 25-year fixed sentence. As to the redlining, the defense was not only concerned about the statement related to alcohol, but also, as we cited in our brief, the statement of cocaine use, which was unsupported and not properly before the court. The court failed to redline that information when an objection was made to the consideration of that.
Mr. Phelps?
Yes.
How do you respond to the state's argument that the information in the PSI and in the GAIN was not incorrect if measured from the date of the interview?
Well, it was incorrect because it talked about cocaine use and alcohol use, and the language of the statement does not support the 1 year argument as being a valid argument. There is certainly alcohol that was involved in this, and the court talked about that there was alcohol involved, but Mr. White did not consume any alcohol after the night of that incident.
But if the gain of but if the evaluation interview was January 2nd, and that was within 12 months of the night of the murder, and it was true that Mr. White consumed alcohol the night of the murder, then didn't he consume alcohol within 4 to 12 months of the interview date?
Well, I guess it would depend upon whether or not that was the contention. It appeared to be that they were contending that that the alcohol was used sometime during the period of incarceration somehow. I know that jails and facilities sometimes have drugs in them, and I know that's always an issue. But the defendant, certainly when they made that range of 4 to 12 months, that might have brought it within that. But the suggestion that there was continued use and is the problem. And the court should have, the problem is we don't have a clear record here as to what the court considered. But there's a failure in this sentence to consider proportionality with the other, with other crimes. And most importantly, to consider the Toohill factor related to the rehabilitation, the potential rehabilitation of the individual defendant here, given what occurred in this particular case and the lack of criminal history of him, as was the rulings on appeal in the State versus Nice and State versus Owen. The court failed to consider potential rehabilitation and went directly to punishment and retribution, and did not consider that alcohol treatment, which the court related to what occurred here, or drug treatment, although I don't believe that, I think it's an alcohol issue in this case, that the ability to rehabilitate the offender, given the alcohol history and that alcohol was involved on that night. Both the victim and the defendant in this case had been drinking alcohol, and there were readings to support both of those. But there's a lack of a clear record given the way the objections were dealt with in this particular case. And we would ask if the court remand this matter back. And the failure to swear in somebody who's testifying, who actually works within the prosecutor's office. Counsel argues the defense didn't have asked for an opportunity to cross-examine. The man was never sworn in. There was never any sworn testimony. He merely got up and testified, and that raises whether or not there's been a confrontational right under the Sixth Amendment. If the person is not sworn, they just get up and give testimony, then there's none of the consideration for if there's potential perjury, and none of the enforcements that follow with sworn testimony. He just got up, was unsworn, and made statements that he's never brought under oath for. And he's an employee of the prosecutor's office prosecuting the case. Cross-examination likely has little value when the person making the statements is not sworn before the court and not subject to perjury or other assurances that come with a sworn testimony. And so counsel argues, well, the defendant didn't ask to cross-examine, but he was never sworn. So cross-examination loses much value when it's not sworn testimony. And in this case, under Nice, State versus Nice and State versus Owen, the court failed to apply all the Toohill factors. And we would ask that the case be remanded for resentencing and clarification of what exactly the court considered at the time of sentencing. Unless you have further questions, I'll yield the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Phelps. The court appreciates the arguments of counsel in this case. The case is submitted and a written decision will issue in due course. The court will be in recess until the 9 a.m. oral argument on Thursday, January 20th.
Thank you.
Thank you.